This is Unheard Cuts on Being. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Nidal Al-Azraq. He works with teenagers at the Laji Center in the West Bank city of Bethlehem. I spoke with him on March 16, 2011, at the Ida refugee camp where the Laji Center is based. This interview is included in our show, Pleasure More Than Hope. Download the MP3 of the produced show at onbeing.org.
If it stays like that, that's fine.
Okay.
I was in Nusseibeh's office at Al-Quds yesterday. It was really loud.
It came on
the last 10 minutes, so we were already kind of tired, and it wasn't, if it had been earlier, we might have stopped, but it was incredibly loud, so that I was having trouble hearing myself think, and he didn't seem to be bothered by it, but part of me felt like we should just stop anyway. But he clearly, anyway, tell me your story about it.
Well, my name is Nidal. I was born and raised here in Ida camp, and I lived almost all my life in this refugee camp where I, witnessed a lot and I learned a lot socially and politically. I got involved in activism early in life. Started in the 80s, late 80s and early 90s. And as many people who worked in politics, we stopped working in politics when Oslo came.
Right, those were the Oslo years, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. When Oslo came. And at that time, I was studying electricity. And I finished the electricity and I started working in Israel, in Jerusalem, and goes all around the place. Then in the beginning of this intifada, I was working actually in this settlement, Abu Ghneim settlement, and I was, seeing the helicopters shooting Bethlehem, and then I decided to not work in Israel in settlements since that. And so I came here, I started working in the streets with the teenagers and the children, trying to first to understand them, to see the similarities and the differences between my generation and their generation, and the challenges that they face. I got involved with Laji in 2002. At that time I was injured badly from the helicopter, so I couldn't work other type of jobs.
Were you here when you were injured?
Yeah, I was here in the camp. It was 2002 on March. It was the invasion of the Church of the Nativity.
Oh, right.
Back then.
Where there was the siege.
There was a siege, a long siege
on
Bethlehem. And I was with my friends. And they started here, actually, in Ida camp, where they brought two helicopters and maybe 600-700 soldiers with many tanks for this small place. And I was injured with other 40 people. Six of them were killed. Since then, I couldn't work in constructions and electricity. And Laji came to me and they offered me a job in a
computer
lab.
And this is this media project? This
is back then, we were in a different location here at the center. We were renting two garages and we had this computer lab. And they asked me to come and operate this computer lab. So I was in a very close contact with kids and teenagers where I really got attached to them. And since then, I devoted my my whole time, my whole life working with the children and teenagers in Ida camp. And now I expand my work through Sautuna project that Laji has been doing since the last 2.5 years. I work in Nablus, in Balata camp, and in Jenin camp, in Jenin, with groups of children and teenagers on different topics related to human rights, democracy, topics like to understand the conflicts and how we can, not live with it, but go around it that we can survive. Basically, my job is to educate these children and teenagers as other volunteers do at Laji Center to prepare them to the future. Because things here are quite complicated socially and politically, very complicated. It's not easy for them to know how to deal with them.
Right.
So it's a tough job because you work with these children, for like a day a week or 2 days a week. But the society has a lot of troubles, the families has a lot of troubles, it's tough work. But as far as I'm seeing, we're succeeding. Hmm. You know, the idea is to find a clean environment, good ground for them to educate them about, not just political issues and cultural issues and that are related to their life and history, and through art, through media, through different kinds of projects, to that they can reach to the level where they can make decisions by themselves. When you're in a conflict, there are a lot of movements, a lot of groups that try to bring people around them. And right. With this process, a lot of manipulatings and a lot of playing in minds. So one of the main ideas that led us start to help these teenagers to reach to the age where they can make their own decisions. Mm-hmm. And this is the tough and hard job.
It's an interesting project also because I think teenagers in any culture, that's also a time when they're perhaps most vulnerable. And also, as you say, being able to make wise decisions for themselves is a challenge.
It's a big challenge.
Almost biologically as well.
Yeah, it's a big challenge here. I mean, I worked with teenagers in the U.S.
Yeah.
And high schools. And I worked with children in the U.S., to educate them about the Israel-Palestine conflicts and to see what level of knowledge they have. Here, you work with them in institutions, but they leave these institutions. The family, their families, have so much troubles because of the, the poverty, the unemployment, and each family has, 8, 10, 11, 15 kids, and the parents are so busy trying to provide like food and education for them, and the street is quite a tough place for them as well. Mm-hmm. So you'll face a lot of challenge with these teenagers and children to let's think about our situation. Let's think and discuss how we can, understand it. And find a way how we can, work on it. One of my main goals working with this teenager is after this 2 and 3 years of working with them, how they can carry the knowledge and the things that they learn and go and change, make some changes in society, mm-hmm. Based on their beliefs, of course, and based on things that believe in. Which is really tough. I actually started this action 2 weeks ago, because now I work with the groups that they have been involved in Sautuna for the past 2 years, and I have a few meetings with them, and I found that they really, really take a step forward and go to the society and try to challenge society. Mm-hmm. But we found that the society is bigger than us and stronger than us. So we started practicing here.
Okay,
for example, the idea of democracy, the idea of the individual in the group, and it's perfect time because of what's going on in the Middle East.
Yes. And are they inspired by that, these teenagers?
A lot. I was shocked. For example, we started with this caricature cartoon by a Palestinian artist. His name is Najil Ali. He has this cartoon where he had Anna, which means me, individual, mm-hmm. and Nahnu, we, the group. And he tried to challenge the two ideas. And I took this idea and we started like drawing this idea and discuss it. And we made big posters. I can show it to you.
Okay.
And we went to the administrator office here at Lagi to test the democracy that we have here. So if you have your place to express your opinion, when you express your opinion, what kind of challenges you'll receive, and are you ready to fight for them, and things like that. And it has been really exciting. And these inspirations, they have them before, but with what's going on in the Middle East,
it's emboldening.
Yeah, it's really, they have so much enthusiastic, they have so much courage, they have so many fantastic ideas, the way mm-hmm. they can like sit and plan. Okay, we'll do the poster, we hold the poster at Lagi, we see the people's reactions, people who support us will bring them to us, and people who disagree with us, we like find a way how you can find them and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it has been really fun to do this with the teenagers here. Mm-hmm. And I do the same job with the people at Jenin and Nablus. And it's a new thing. Mm-hmm. Usually we used to challenge the occupation here, you know, with different kind of resistance, you know, demonstrations, stones, and all these type of resistance. But now it's time to challenge the society and to
Right. It seems like the challenge is going both externally and internally.
That's true.
Uh-huh.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask you, compared to your generation, in terms of how you saw the future unfolding, and these kids now, or these young people, you know, do they have a different vision of what's possible?
That's a very good question, actually. I sense this. My wife and I, Amal, we made this documentary together. It took us 6 years of doing this documentary, and we tried to compare the two generations, the old generation who was involved in the political movements in the First Intifada, and who've been into the prison, and to the new generation who have been involved in this Intifada, and see their like visions to the conflicts and to the future, and how they resist, how they thought of the occupation and about the social things. So I find that many of them got lost because of the complications of society, socially and politically, and they need to be led. They need to be educated. They need to be. They need to be, you know, showing the path for this. Mm-hmm. So they have different type of visions. For example, I propose this question. You know, this right to return issues that is really big and complicated and has been going on since 1948 is an issue for them. So we proposed this question for them. So you'll be able to live with Israelis on the same land. If you offer to go back to your village, you will go. For example, how you can see the future of Palestine. Actually, this is our next magazine at Lagi, with the 6 different refugee camps in the West Bank, thinking of the future and the possibilities of the Israel-Palestinian conflicts. So many of them, I really ready to go back to my village. I heard a lot about it from my grandparents, from my parents. Some of them, I was born here, and I don't know if I can return. Some of them, I would like to go and live near the beach, you know, right. Yeah, I'll come, you know, I like water, you know, these type of things. They like the idea of one state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard for them to explain for them, like, the one state, two state solutions, demographically and geographically. But they know that they want one state solution. Another issue is, to be honest with you, many of the teenagers and the kids who have lost their parents in this conflict, and their parents, you know, they were like killed in front of them by snipers, mm-hmm. through the invasions, and to discuss the idea of like to live in one state. What do you think of the future of Palestinians and Israelis living together, and all of these things? They have different issues. They still have this anger and hurts feelings inside them. And but they have the ability to move on with it, you know. But they're really struggling, as many people here in the West Bank struggling. And you know, sometimes I discuss the issue of forgiveness. You know, sometimes, you know, we enter like some philosophical topics to these children, and they're good at it. What do you think of forgiveness? You know, you've lost, they've lost a lot, and you'll receive some kind of answers. I can't forgive now because there's no ground for forgiveness. I have occupations, I have walls, soldiers come every night to the camp, mm-hmm. checks, arrests, you know. So some kids, I need justice before I forgive, I need my rights before I forgive. So their view, their vision of the future is really quite complicated. They all agree that, we really would love to live in one state without walls, without checkpoints. I can go to the beach and I can, you know, go to my village. They have the ground for it. But because, you know, as I said before, some of them, you know, their parents are martyrs. They have families in prison, and the occupation really affected them, especially here in Ida Camp, because the location of Ida Camp is very close to, as you see, the settlements, very close to the military camps here. Most of the conflicts and the clashes used to start here and ends here. So it's really, they really got damaged psychologically from the side.
There's so much pain and damage all around that it's like, that complicates all the other issues. I
mean,
that human pain becomes a factor. And, you know, I think people in the States, as you realize, they often think of this as a religious conflict.
Oh, yes.
Right. And but I mean, the layers of this, there are so many layers, and that's just one of them. But is religion part of these young people's? Does religion play in, or does it at all, into their reactions or
reaction to the conflicts?
Yeah, or when they talk about forgiveness, or just how they cope in their day to day lives.
You know, based on my experience in the past 9 or 10 years working with children and teenagers, I can say it comfortably, religion is not the issue.
Yeah.
When it comes to when it comes to the conflicts, for example, all their parents grow up working in Jerusalem and Israel's. There was a time when during Oslo and before Oslo, when all the Israelis used to come and shop here, and the checkpoint was open, and many people used to go there inside Jerusalem and see the places. So when you propose this for them, when you say, okay, Jewish and Palestinians, they say Israelis and Palestinians. They don't say Jewish and Muslims. The conflicts between Israelis and Palestinians, the conflicts between religious settlers and villagers, they don't use the terms of these big terms like religious Muslims are fighting Jews.
Right, it's not a conflict between Islam and Judaism.
Yeah, and they have quiet because they watch a lot of TV and without watching the TV, the conflicts is around them. They living it life, and they face during their daily life some Islamic movements and some left movements, and they have different views. Of course, when you talk to a kid or to a teenager from a religious family here, he will be using these religious terms in terms of struggle and in terms of we should fight and we should things like that. But even though when they use these terms, they will use them as a relation of this is a conflict between Israelis and Palestinians and we should fight to gain our rights. They don't use the term, for example, jihad.
Right.
In their discussions, even those religious kids. Yeah. So I get the sense of the issue of religion when it comes to the Israeli conflicts. I think they have, they know that it's not a religious conflict. They know it's a conflict based on first on land and based on territories, based on the right to return, based on the refugee case, because they have been educated also. By this, you know, for example, place like Lajee Center and as many good organizations in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, you know, they educate these kids and teenagers about the conflicts a lot. We have good leadership in the streets who work on this also. So when we work with them, we even when we use these terms, it's a political conflict. It has different agendas than the religious conflicts. We're not, in the 18th or 17th century. Nobody is gonna throw anybody in the sea. Nobody is gonna. These are, some propaganda terms. Sometimes they heard them and they got excited about them, but they realized that it's not the case.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, my experience with them, it's really politically, fully politically, not religiously.
So I asked him all this, but, you know, what's the Palestinian story or what Palestinian stories would you want to tell that don't make it into news headlines or, you know, that simply don't get covered? What comes to mind? I'm sure there are hundreds.
There's a lot.
What
there's
comes
a hundreds.
To mind?
Yeah. There's a hundreds of for example, when late 2006, I did some workshops in New York City, in Brooklyn, high schools, Brooklyn, educate them about Palestine, Israel conflicts. And I was shocked by the amount of information that these teenagers, like high school children, they have. Strangely enough, some of them thought that Israel is in Europe.
Really?
Yeah. They don't know that this area, you know, they don't know that the Middle East, not all Muslims, they have like, they think that the whole Middle East speaks Arabic. They don't know that we have Jewish, Muslims, Christians, Turks, Persians. When it comes to to Palestine-Israel conflicts, they have a fully believe that it's a religious conflict. And the idea of the Holocaust and the idea of the Jews from back then in Europe still in their minds, which is reality, and it's important to educate the kids about it. But they don't know that it's about, you know, lands, and it's politically conflicts. So these are one of the important topics and issues that the West and the young generation in the West need to be educated about, and to have a sense that we have Muslims and Jews, but we have Christians also mm-hmm. living in this, mm-hmm. and they have a long history mm-hmm. with this land. I mean, Jesus was born here. You know, one kid once asked me, you know, who has a right to own this land? I said Christians. Jews and Muslims should, you know. Because why? Because, you know, Jesus was born here. And, you know, I was like joking with him, you know.
Yes.
It's like, Jesus was born here and they have the right, you know, to leave this country and blah, blah, blah. So the many teenagers in the West, they miss these concepts, and they're missing this information mm-hmm. For them. Another thing about Muslims and Christians, issues when it comes, for example, for an area like Bethlehem, and my wife has been doing a lot of writing about it. For example, this Aida camp, it has a wall, but when you talk about Bethlehem city, you talk about Bethlehem as a holy place.
Right.
But Bethlehem as a holy place, it has like Bedouins, it has refugees, it has Christians and Muslims and people who live in the city. So it's not all about the city and the people who live in the city. It's also, you have some fractions around the city like Aida Camp, like El Khadr village, who are struggling every day with the occupation to survive.
Right.
The issue of land, which is the most, in my opinion, the most important thing to discuss in the West, is the land.
Mm-hmm.
Because the struggle is all about the land.
Mm-hmm.
It's even not about refugees, because refugees need land.
Right, and you're right, it's elemental, and it's precisely what never gets discussed.
Yeah.
It doesn't get transmitted.
Yeah, because in the media, right now, with the negotiation, they're making Jerusalem is the big issue. But if you go to the ground and you look from the sky in Jerusalem, it's very easy to have a solution for Jerusalem. But they're making it really big and complicated because they don't want to talk about the land and the refugee case. So land here is a major issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right now we have 10% of the West Bank. We started in 19 when Israel was recognized in 1948. There was 47% for the Jewish and 43% mm. for Palestinians.
Mm.
In the 1967 war, we had 22% of the land. Now, because of the settlements and the wall, we had less than 10% of the land. So these are the facts that not many people know in the West.
Mm-hmm.
And these are major issues. Without talking about them, without finding a solution for them, I don't think this conflict will be finished and solved
mm-hmm.
soon. Mm. You know.
You know, I spoke with a Jewish journalist, Israeli journalist, who also was American born. He's
mm-hmm.
lived here for a long time. And you know, he's one of these. He's very hard to categorize. I think
mm-hmm.
that's true of people in general. Here, Americans tend to say, you know, you're right or you're left, right? You're this or you're that. And here,
mm-hmm.
people have so many layers of identity. So
okay.
I would say in some ways he's conservative, and in other ways he would look like he's on the left. You
okay.
can imagine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he's grown pretty. He was one of these people who was very thrilled by Oslo and what seemed possible then, and then has become very bitter and was embittered by the Second Intifada, right? Despite that, when I asked him how change might come, you know, how might this all change? He said he thought it might happen suddenly, and the example he used was Sadat coming to Jerusalem, and how that was this kind of miraculous moment for Israelis, and then there was also a land given back, right, at that moment, that it was this kind of instantaneous change despite this history of very complex struggle. I don't know, is that a vision that a Palestinian could have, that something might happen and it would all look different?
No. I think people here are becoming more realistic about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, about this conflict, especially Palestinians, especially refugees, because they have facts. They have, for example, when you talk to refugees, Palestinian refugees, about the future, well, say, forget the negotiation, forget Oslo, because Oslo is based on vague idea. They said it's simple. We have this land. The land is complex now. It has Israelis living in it. Let's live together without one state solution. This is their talk. Without one state solution, that we will be able to go back to the land. Nothing would happen, because the way we think about it here, about the future and about this miracle that may happen one day, we have new generations every 5 or every 6 or every 10 years are coming here, and they're coming and living in a very tight place. These generations, every 5 or 10 years, they explode because they have no place to go.
In the refugee camps.
In the refugee camps, especially. They have no place to go. So, and they start, since the First Intifada, they have been doing, they have been shaping the future of the conflicts. For example, we have the First Intifada, we had Oslo, Oslo failed. We have this new conflict that started in 2000, and it's failed now, politically failed. And they think about the future that... No, without right to return, there's no miracles going to happen. Without thinking of the facts that are on the ground, Jerusalem, okay, one of them, the refugees, the 12 refugee camps in Lebanon, that they're living in a hard condition, without discussing the refugees from 1948, not just the refugees from 1967, the future wouldn't be, there will not be any optimism in the future for this conflict, but about somebody would come with a solution from outside. I don't think this will happen.
The solution has to be inside.
It has to be. It has to start from inside. It has to start from inside. It has to start from both people.
Yeah.
You know, it has people here. They believe that they realized now, because they have a really right wing in government in Israel, and we have a corrupt government in the Palestinian side. People start realizing that both people need to
you're talking about the people, not the elected representatives.
Yes, have to move, and they have to break these boundaries, but without normalizing things and without being naive and talking about peace. Yeah, it's nice. But without talking of peace, without justice, And I hear this talk by many people, there is no future for the Palestinian Authority, because politically they're failed, they're corrupt. The Israeli government is really right-wing government. And it's about people. And this talk is coming because of what's going on in the Middle East.
Right.
Like how the people sparked in the street and they made change.
So Egypt then plays into something that was already happening here.
Oh, yeah. Egypt, everybody is really focusing fully on Egypt. First, because Egypt has this peace agreement with Israel, and the new government will make some changes in relation to Israel and relation, and Egypt is a big country and a major player politically. It's a major player in the Middle East. And the revolution there, you know, so mm-hmm. far is succeeding mm-hmm. in terms of like changes, mm-hmm. changes socially and politically changes. And really people are inspired by it. And they still, you know, really having this energy inside them they want to, you know, mm-hmm. use because of Egypt. So, yeah, all the eyes on Egypt now. Mm-hmm. All the eyes on Egypt. Mm.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Have you asking one question?
Sure.
So when you guys are talking about psychological trauma, it seems like almost every Palestinian I've either talked to or listened to has a father, a brother, an uncle that's been imprisoned in somehow. Mm. And then I'm harkening back to Amal's story about just even going into Jerusalem with your new infant.
Yeah.
And that there's a psychological trauma there. I mean, I've been gone for a week, and my son had his first sleepover. Mm-hmm. And I feel the miss. I miss that. And I just wonder how that factors into going forward as you talk about that, too. There's another level of trauma or issues to deal with.
You mean being a father?
Well, so there's the very blatant, like, I have family in prison that also may unite people, but I also have these little things that I miss out on each day. And how does one kind of wrestle with that? Is there ways of transcending that, or mm-hmm. are there ways of kind of being beholden to it?
Mm-hmm. So
you're talking about children, or
and
as
parents,
a family,
I
or
think,
parents,
and family
or
members. Family. Yeah, these layers of psychological trauma of mm-hmm. people in prison, people killed, being separated from loved ones for mm-hmm. all kinds of different reasons. How do people live with that, or how do they? Is it possible to kind of carve out a sense of dignity, to transcend it? What makes that possible?
You know, one of the thing that we learned when we were children, I'm talking about my experience now as a child, we learned this lesson not by our parents or our families. We learned this lesson by the life, that it's the three things: is how to survive, and how to live with pain, and how to rely on yourself as children. Hmm. How to survive because it's a conflict. A bullet may come to you anytime. You need to learn early in age how to avoid it. How to live with your pain because you may get arrested or beating or humiliated in checkpoint. Not live with it and, you know, cope with it and accept it, but how to go around it and continue with your life because it's happening on an everyday basis. You will get really damaged if you cannot, as a child, as a teenager, as a parent, if you don't know how to deal with these things. It could really damage you and destroy you. Yeah, we have a lot of damage, psychological damage mm-hmm. inside us, and a lot of sadness inside us, but we have the hope and we have the mechanism and we learned early in life how to cope with it, of course, with lots of suffering, and how to survive. Also, we learned this lesson when we were children because, you know, your parents may get killed or arrested, and your brothers and sisters, and you need to find your way in the society. I mean, remembering my childhood, like my family in the 80s were politically were very active. Like, our house got demolished once and got closed once, and my sisters went to prisons, my old brothers went to prison. I mean, I'm the youngest of 11. And my father was busy, you know, providing like lawyers and providing like food to the mm-hmm. family. So I grow up, even though I'm the youngest, I should be spoiled in a sense. But I grow up basically in the streets. And other families raised me, other people raised me in the streets, and I've learned a lot. Yes, it did affected me, and I still carry this psychological issues in my mind and my memories, but on the other hand, it gave me the strength to survive. Because, as I said, you really, really need to rely on yourself early in life, early, in your like young teenagers. Mm. And life is hard here, and you have to find your way. Other children, they can't do that. Not everybody can do that, but most people can do that. Some children got really psychologically damaged. For example, we have children that they're mothers and their fathers were shot in front of them. They're bombed in front of them. They lost them. They had a very close, very direct clashes with the army during the invasions. Add to that the social pressure on them because of the conflicts that they have been seeing, you know, social workers and psychologists since age 6 and 7, and they still continue with this. So it's a problem that it needs a lot of work. It needs a lot of, I don't know exactly what I can say about it, but it happens every day. It happens many times during the day, and it's like one time I gave a talk at Boston, and an American from the audience asked me, I went to Palestine, and even though there's like a lot of sadness and anger and occupation, but people are smiling and joking all the time and trying this. I told them, well, it's one of the resistance elements. Not just to resist the occupation, to resist your pain, your fear, because it's always around you. You can't let this fear and let these things to destroy you. So you, even though you feel you have the pain inside you, but you need to laugh and you need to smile and you need to play, you need to move in your life. And I think because, for example, early in life, we learn to not show our fear to the occupiers. And there's a very, very strong video. Actually, it's Khulod's relative. She's a teacher. And they bombed the door, and she was behind the door, and she was killed. So her daughter was like 6 years old, was crying and begging the soldier to bring, to call the ambulance. So her brother, which he's 11 years old, he came and asked her to not cry in front of the soldier. And I was, for me, I know why he did this. Mm-hmm. I understand, but I was shocked to see this boy asking his 6 years old sister to not cry in front of the soldiers, because we learned early, like, okay, don't show your tears to the occupier. This is one of the resistant elements and all these things. Yes, it damaged us, but I have to say it gave us something positive. Things. It's hard. It's weird to
also,
hear it, to listen to it, to believe it even. But it has a lot of negative sides. But based on my experience, who witnessed and lived the first intifada and lived the second intifada, and I participated in many of these activism, yes, I can say it's hard psychologically and every level, but I have some strength by it. It
also makes me think that if Palestinians and Israelis live together one day, part of that would be having to learn to show your pain to each other.
Yeah. Well, that's another excellent point, which wouldn't be easy.
No.
It wouldn't be easy.
No. It would take generations, wouldn't
yes,
it?
Yes.
It would take people living towards that.
Yeah. You need to find the ground for it,
right.
And slowly people will do it, but it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard.
Mm-hmm.
And even as Middle Eastern culture, Arab culture, especially for boys and men, you need to be tough. You need to be not show your tears, even though. We struggle so hard when we bring psychologists and social workers to work with the teenagers to talk about their feelings. This is one of the major struggles here in Palestine. Just talk about your feelings, you feel better, we'll find a way to help you in this. It takes us months and years, for them to reach to the level, yes, oh yeah, I believe that this is good for me. Yeah, I feel comfortable, I feel good about it, and I can talk about my feelings, about how I feel, what type of things that I face in my life. So, it's not easy.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Nidal
al-Azraq.
Okay. Are we still running? I was aware that we were about to run out of time.
Yeah, perfect.
Okay, good. Thank you.
So yeah, sure. Thank you.
So what time do activities start around the center of the week?
Where the school will be, when the students are?
12:30
when they leave the school, and they, because the schools here are run, operate for 2 shifts.
Oh, okay.
Not this year.
Not this year. What did they do?
They switched the schools. So the bigger school is now for girls, because we have a bigger number of girls. And put more students in each classroom.
How many?
40.
Used to be 2 shifts.
10.
Yeah, okay.
Used to be 2 shifts.
So there'll be kids coming to the center soon? Half hour?
Yeah, there could be children coming. And there's really that fantastic shot from the roof. You can see the whole camp on the wall around the camp. And if you're interested to go up and take a look.
We probably have to get ruling. We have another interview this afternoon.
Okay.
So, but I was, if it was imminent, I'd get a mic out.